Hallo, schön, dass du reinhörst zum Evolve Podcast. Der Podcast für persönliches Wachstum, unternehmerisches Denken und gesellschaftlichen Wandel. Mein Name ist Jasmin Chiara Bauer, ich bin Gründerin, Autorin und derzeit Guest Lecturerin an der Stanford University und ich darf heute wieder ein wunderschönes Interview teilen mit einem Professor von Stanford, und zwar mit Dr. Bernard Roth. Bernard Roth ist, ja, wie schon gesagt, Professor an der D-School am Stanford Campus und ist unter anderem auch Gründer des Hasno-Plattner-Institut sowie Autor des Buches The Achievement Habit, worum es auch in dieser Folge heute geht, denn wir haben darüber gesprochen, was es ausmacht, ein gutes Leben zu führen und wie du das erreichen kannst. Und zwar vor allem auch, indem du Ziele erreichst und dir Ziele setzt. Aber nicht nur einfach Ziele, um irgendwelche Erfolge zu feiern oder Erfolge zu erreichen, sondern Ziele, die dir ein glückliches und erfülltes Leben geben. Und wir sprechen auch darüber, wie du Entscheidungen treffen kannst, wie du leichte Entscheidungen treffen kannst, aber auch, warum es manchmal gar nicht so wichtig ist, Entscheidungen zu treffen. Und vor allem sprechen wir darüber, wie du Verantwortung für deine eigenen Emotionen übernehmen kannst. Vor allem für Emotionen, die du vielleicht nicht so gerne fühlst oder die du gerne loswerden möchtest oder die dich, Dinge, die dich einfach triggern und bestimmte Emotionen hervorrufen. Und ich freue mich jetzt einfach noch eine weitere Folge, ein weiteres Interview mit dir dieses Jahr zu teilen. Das Jahr neigt sich ja schon dem Ende, wir sind schon wieder im Dezember und ja, ich freue mich einfach so sehr, dass du da bist und jetzt ein weiteres Mal reinhörst in den Evolve Podcast und wünsche dir an dieser Stelle erstmal ganz, ganz viel Spaß beim Zuhören. So, I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Bernie Roth in my podcast today. He's a professor for mechanical engineering at the D-School in Stanford on campus. And I'm so happy to meet you today and to talk about your habit achievements and also about your path here as a professor in Stanford. So welcome to Evolve.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
And maybe before we start, can you just elaborate a bit on your story? So what is your story behind being a professor here on campus? As I also know, you are one of the founders of the Hasso-Plattner Institute. So what was your path and your story?
Well, I was a student in New York City where I was born and grew up and eventually got my PhD from Columbia University. And then I interviewed at some places and actually chose to come to Stanford by virtue of some people that were working here and were more, it was somewhat unusual from the people I was used to at Columbia. So although I was very happy there and I could have stayed there the rest of my life, I chose to come out here and I started as a professor in mechanical engineering in a group called the Design Group, or it was called the Design Division in those days. And we were a small group of faculty and we taught a normal machine design kind of courses. And then I got interested in creativity and problem solving a little bit outside of just machines, but what we call the human potential movement. So that was sort of the influence of California on me. And I combined that kind of thinking with my teaching at Stanford. And ultimately I started teaching creativity workshops and combining that with my standard engineering work, which was initially in what's called kinematics, but then migrated to robotics. So I was one of the founders of robotics at Stanford and in the world. So that was a big part of my life for a long time. And then many years later, the creativity thing became more a bigger part of my life. And ultimately we needed a new venue to give our courses, and we wanted to bring together people from all different parts of the university. So we created the D-School, and we fortunately found Hasso-Plattner, who was willing to give us funding to do it. And we started to make this new institute, which is called the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford, which we nicknamed the D-School, and that's sort of stuck. So that's, and then at some point I decide to write a book about my experience and my teaching learnings and things that I felt worked well with other people. So I wrote my book, The Achievement Habit, about 5 years ago, and just been mainly now moved into the D school, work teaching there and working there. And I'm the so-called academic director of the D school. And I've basically given up my robotics research. I still have my friends there and I occasionally go to meetings, but I don't really do serious research in robotics anymore. I'm mainly doing research and teaching in the D school environment. So that's in a nutshell my life.
Really, really interesting. And you said that you also wrote a book about things you learned about your teaching. Yeah. So what did you learn? And maybe also you said like that something here and on campus is different to the places you were before. So maybe, so what did you learn and what is different to other places?
Well, the main difference was that basically when I went to school, which was a long time ago, in traditional engineering, engineering just involved machines, and especially my mechanical engineering, it didn't involve people. So the big difference is what's called now human-centered design, or design with empathy, or whatever you want to call it. But basically, that's the main difference, that now a lot of the problems we solve are directly human-centered. There's no machines involved at all. And even the ones where machines are involved, again, there's a more emphasis on the user and the people, and not only their physical dimensions, but their emotional states and issues like that, which when I started going to school, those were considered heresy for an engineer to consider those things. They were belong to psychologists or medical people and all that. So, it's just been a big change in the field and the way it's done professionally and in corporations. And we've sort of been part of the leaders of that change. Yeah.
And what would you say, like, how did creativity, and especially to learn and to apply creativity in work and in teaching, how did it change over the years? And maybe how is it different now? Sure.
There's a lot of changes. One is the idea of originally the idea of creativity was there's this lone genius, just the one person. And now the idea is more of group work and group creativity. And again, just the emphasis of not just taking a slow improvement, but this whole idea of disruptive creativity is more fashionable, and it's more in the culture now, whereas before it was mainly incremental kinds of things that people considered creativity. So but again, it's a word that's very not exactly defined. Everyone has their own definition, and I don't really put that much stock in the word. It's just it's a useful word to say, let's just think about what we're doing and how we're doing it. Let's try and do it in a better way and in a new way. So that's whereas before the idea was, especially in engineering, you memorized a lot of things and then you repeated the things you memorized. And if you were a good engineer, you knew a lot of these things. And that was kind of considered the professional standard. And now the standard is really to be more self-sufficient and more generate things yourself, not so much repeat what you've learned before. Mm-hmm. So it's a sort of a different emphasis of these things. Still good to know things. It's still good to know a lot of things. The more you hurt in general, the more you know in general, it doesn't hurt you. Yeah. So there's nothing wrong with that. But the emphasis, and when I went to school, was just repetition and memorization. And that's not the fashion anymore. It's a create your own ideas and your own things. And we try and inculcate that in our students. Not to just follow and give me back what I gave them, but to think for themselves and be more self-sufficient. Yeah. We call it personal efficacy. We try and emphasize that.
Yeah. And this is something I really like about the D school, that you really not only have like theories and just like the frontal teaching, but also like really hands-on things. It's really practical. Yeah. But like at so many other places, and especially like if you work sometimes in a company for a long time at the same place, or also like also in universities in Germany, like we have like still this big classes and just like theory, and then you learn it and then you just put it out again. So how can we foster creativity? What are like maybe techniques or something? How can we get more creative in the thing in our day-to-day life, especially in work and university?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's like anything. It's like building muscles if you're an athlete, or doing exercises. It's you learn by doing, and the more you do, the more you learn. And it's if you're open-minded and willing to try new things, it's useful. So in education, we try and give the students the experience of being responsible for their own work, and in fact, choosing their own work as much as possible. And we try and guide them, and you know, we're there as a resource, but we're not there as the person. You know, I don't give them questions I know the answers to. You know, traditionally the idea was there's some one right answer for something, and the professor knows it, and the student's going to learn the answer, and they'll be able to regurgitated back to the professor. So that's not in fashion anymore. And most of the things I talk about, I don't really know the answers. You know, it's we're all of us learning, and there's generally no one right answer to the things we talk about. So it's a kind of atmosphere that's it's exciting, because you're generating a lot of things. It's not just rote memorization. So we try and do that in various ways. There's a lot of techniques, and there's a lot of different ways. And the basic idea is learning by doing rather than by lecturing. So in the old days, I used to stand up on stage and give lectures to classes, maybe hundreds of people, but usually, you know, dozens of people at least. And they would take the notes and all that. And then I'd give an exam, and they'd give me back what I gave on the notes, you know. That was the traditional way. Now I don't lecture very much at all, but I'm interacting with them, but I'm not lecturing with them. And they're talking as much as I'm talking. So, you know, you go around the room and people have say different things, and they learn from each other, and they learn from me too. But, and I learn from them, you know, so yeah. It's a different atmosphere.
And this is something really interesting, because also like the students here, they are like our future generations. They are like future leaders, and they take these techniques, they take this learning, and they bring it to our future. But there will be so many challenges we will have maybe in the future. So how can we use and apply the techniques of what we learn here and in the D school, and also the students to tackle these challenges? Is there a specific mindset or like techniques that we can apply to like really tackling these big challenges?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are processes and techniques we give them, but they're just, just starting points. They're useful. If you don't know what to do, then you follow a recipe, you know what to do next, and hopefully it'll help you. But basically, you know, if you're a professional and you're competent, every problem it needs a different approach even. So it's not just the solution is different, the approach is different. And so depending on the problem, you may use all sorts of different tools. And if you have a good vocabulary of tools, then it's easier to get the appropriate ones. But basically a lot of these things are luck, you know, somehow you come up with the right idea, and there's no guarantee you will. But we have these tools that are basically very useful, and generally we do a lot of what's called reframing. So we don't you take a problem and give it to me, and I always say, if you have like a business mind, if someone says to me, Bernie, do this and this, and I'm working for them, I say, yes, sir, I salute them, and I say, I'll give it for you tomorrow. And then the new idea is, if they tell me that, I say, okay, let me think about that. Mm-hmm. And I'll go back, and maybe I'll come back tomorrow and say, you know, I think maybe we want to solve a different problem. I think it's not the right thing. I've looked into it, and I think, and so it's a kind of more, it's more open to appropriateness rather than just getting the job done and not thinking about what's the better way of doing stuff. So we're more open to just things that aren't the first thing that come to mind. Mm-hmm. And people generally, the human person is built that, you know, the first solution you come to mind, you take that and you run with that. And so we have to train people to resist that and to say, okay, I have this solution, but can I get a better one? And is it the right problem I solved and things like that? So, you know, we teach people to ask themselves those kind of questions, and we do a lot of reframing, and we do a lot of different approaches to problems. And, you know, so we've had some really great successes and some failures, and nothing is perfect and nothing works. People are different, and some people work well alone. Some people work well in groups, and, you know, so each person has to find their own way that they work best. But you have certain general principles that usually work for a lot of people, but nothing works for everybody.
Yeah. And then also, like, the students here, that what I especially experienced, that so many of them have all of them this achievement oriented characteristics. So, like, we are in a really, really good environment, and like the people are really bold to reach to a high point and to be really successful. But at sometimes they also say, okay, but I'm still not good enough as the other ones. So, like, you are at the best universities, but still I have the feeling it's not enough. And like, it could be more, like, really this achievement oriented mindset, but also like in a good way, but also in a bad way. What do you think about this pressure on this achievement?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, it depends on the individual. So some people are overly certain of their abilities, and some people are under reliant on their abilities. So, you know, we all have self-images, and in general, you know, if you do things and you succeed, you feel good about yourself and you feel more confident. But that's, individuals have different characteristics. So some people are overconfident to the degree of arrogance, and they're dangerous that they're so overconfident. And some people are really confident, but don't feel it. So, you know, we try and encourage people. We try and avoid competition. I think, I personally don't think competition is a good thing. A lot of people use competition in teaching and stuff. I think it's much better to teach people to cooperate and work together. And I think things like Silicon Valley, people think they're all competing against each other. And there is a lot of competition, of course, but there's also a lot of cooperation between people who knew each other at some company or went to school together. And there's a whole network of people, even very famous people, who help each other. So, you know, this whole idea of just the lone person and the shark attacking everybody, there are some examples, but most people are really in a community and they rely on a lot of other people for support. And but, you know, individuals have different psychological makeups, so you can't. But in terms of teaching, you know, I, of course, try and recognize that and try and support people, and especially if people have a low self-image, I try as much as I can to help build it up for them. And give them tools. But, you know, it's not uncommon for people who have all top grades to think that they're fooling everybody and that they're not really that good. And it's also not uncommon for some people with terrible grades to think they're better than they are, you know, so it's all over the place. But, you know, what you can do as a teacher is try and find what each individual needs and as much as you can support them.
Yeah. And what can, or how can we learn to get more an achievement orientation without having too much competition in it?
Yeah, well, first of all, the word, I use achievement a little bit differently than most people. So you may mean by achievement to become king of, or queen of the universe. What I mean by achievement is to have a good life, and to, when you die, your friends don't have to lie about you when they talk about you at your funeral. So I mean achievement to be, have personal satisfaction, not necessarily gaining money or gaining stature or things like that. Because I find often those things are just not the negative spin on positive achievement. Mm-hmm. So what I mean is, you know, just have a good life that's appropriate for you. Mm-hmm. And you have to find your own way that way. And the best way is by experience. And, you know, going to school gives you a set of experiences. Just being alive gives you a set of experiences. And if you're thoughtful about that and you use that to build yourself up, then in general, you know, you will succeed for what satisfies you. And, you know, I have, you know, I'd say all my friends will have different goals and different levels of what they're satisfied. But basically, achievement to me is a personal thing, not a kind of scorecard in the world.
And what would you say, what is a good life then for you? And has it changed over time?
What I consider achievement?
A good life. Well, what do you consider as a good life for you, for yourself?
Yeah, well, no, I'd say, you know, not really. I'd say my values have, you know, I grow, of course, as you go older, you grow and things change when you get older than when you were younger. But I'd say I haven't changed in any massive way. I say I still have the same basic social ideas, same basic political ideas. I still treat people pretty much the same way I've always treated them. I still have I have been married for over 60 years. I still have the same wife. I still have the same children. I still have many of the same friends for a long time. And so I'd say, you know, for Mike, you could either say I'm pretty dull since I don't change much, or you could say I'm pretty stable and I have a stable life that I find very satisfying. So I think I'm very lucky personally. I think, you know, I think a lot of life is luck, you know, just things happen to you in the right place and the right time. You get opportunities and you take the right ones and you don't take the bad ones. And I feel I've been lucky that way and I'm grateful for that. So, you know, I'd say, okay, and, you know, opportunities come along and there are changes, like the D school has been a big change in my life. But still in all, it's sort of a continuum. I'm still a professor, mm-hmm. still at the same university, still in the same house. So things change and yet they remain the same. So it depends on what level you look at them. But basically, I feel very fortunate and I'm glad I had the life I had. Mm. So it's like, you can't be luckier than that, right?
Yeah, that's really beautiful. Yeah. And also like people often say, like, if I'm now too happy with my life right now, if I'm saying, okay, I'm good enough, I love my life like as it is, wouldn't that be contradicted with like with my rest of the goals in my life, like that I stop myself of achieving more in this?
Well, you know, you can't be happy. You're only happy at the moment, and the next moment you could be sad, you could be suicidal the next moment. So it's not a thing, it's not like an injection that you get an inoculation and it keeps you for your whole life. Mm-hmm. Even the virus inoculation doesn't work that way, right? People are getting booster shots and the flu shot, you get a flu shot every year. So that's the same analogy, really. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea is you want to have a flu shot every year, mm-hmm. okay? And if you don't get the flu shot, then you're static. But if you get the flu shot, you're doing the same thing. It's nothing new, right? But you're sort of staying alive and keeping yourself well and doing whatever you do. Mm-hmm. So I view my life as very dynamic. And yet if you made a list of the stuff, it would probably be the same list I've had for the last 10 years, maybe. Yeah. But it's, you know, I'll teach the same class 40 times. And every time I go in there, it's new and exciting to me, because I don't know exactly what I'm going to say and I don't know exactly what the students are going to say. And it's all new students and yet it's the same class as last 40 years. Yeah. So, but it's the most exciting thing. I just had a session on Thursday, which I thought was incredible, and for me and the students. And that class I must have taught 12 times already, but it can be very exciting. So, and you know, some people change all the time and they don't like what they're doing and it's terrible and they want to quit their jobs and all that. So it's all my version of achievement is not the same of what's. Some people think if you change, you change, you change, it's achievement. That's not my version of it. My version is to make it a way that it's exciting and satisfying and all that. And it's, so it's a kind of different thing. So maybe I shouldn't have called my book The Achievement Habit. I have a friend, she told me, she said, Bernie, I'd never buy a book with achievement in the title.
Yeah, because some people already have a picture in mind, probably, but it's also nice to change.
But if you read the book, I do define what I mean by achievement. The problem is people use their own definitions.
But it's also fine. and also like to look for this really happy and fulfilled life, and also like being in this moment, but also in the future. Like I think a big part of it is making decisions and making really strong decisions for oneself. But so many people struggle with making the right decisions. What do you think, or like what is like maybe an approach to make faster decisions for oneself?
I think it's overrated, the decisions. It doesn't matter which decision you make, because the end is the same. You're going to die. No matter what decisions you make, you're going to die at the end of your life, okay? So that's the end. And so wherever you are, it's a question of how you get to the end. And in general, it doesn't matter that much. So some people think the decision is the best decision they ever made. Some people think it's the worst decision. But A, you don't know, because at the time, you don't know at all, because you don't know where it leads. So some people lead to a decision where they get a terrible job or it didn't work out well and they get fired and they get almost suicidal. But then it turns out that it was the best thing that ever happened for them. And they didn't know that until a few years later. And some people think they've gotten the world's best thing. They've won the prize and all that. And then they get killed. So you don't know until it's all over what was and all that. So you can't even worry about that. So I think that, in fact, the whole idea of decisions, people like losing sleep over decisions, is just a waste of time, basically. And most of the time, people know what they're going to do, even though they pretend they don't. And they agonize, you know, should to be or not to be, Hamlet's thing. So, I have a bunch of exercises with students who have decision problems. And I think life is very, my life is full of accidents that I didn't plan on. And I didn't plan to be at Stanford. I came to California for a free vacation, changed my job from professor at Columbia to a professor here just overnight based on some crazy thing, some guy I liked, and he died 2 years later. So that was my reason to come to Stanford. The guy died. Seems like a terrible, but it actually turned out to be great. So how would I know? And if I stayed at Columbia, I might even had a greater life. How do I know? You don't know. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter, whatever you are, is how you've been there and you've gotten there by some act. Most people, if you ask them their decisions and stuff, it's been accidents. It's not planned. Very few people, there are people who plan their life and they plan all that. They're not any happier, incidentally. And it may or may not work out as they planned, and so on. So I think that whole idea of decisions and planning is so overrated. It's just a matter of being capable and being open to whatever happens and to what opportunities come, and then being lucky to choose the right ones without knowledge. I mean, there's no way to know. There's absolutely no way to know what's going to happen the next year or the next day even. Mm-hmm. So this whole idea of planning and all that, it's kind of a lot of nonsense. You may be lucky. It may turn out the way you thought. And it may turn out the opposite way. You're even luckier. Who knows? You know. So if you have that attitude towards life, it doesn't really matter what you do. It's just how you do it and how it feels to you that matters. And I could teach, I think I could be just as happy teaching history or English, or not even teaching, or just wandering, or just, I mean, it just, if you're happy, it doesn't matter in a way. If you're unhappy, it doesn't matter either, because you're going to be unhappy no matter what you do. You know, some people, we once had a woman who worked for me, she was divorced six times. Could you imagine that? I mean, it's unbelievable. So clearly she kept trying to get happier and happier. It didn't seem to work, you know? So it's just, that's the same thing. You can spend your whole life looking for happiness and not find it, or you can have it and be lucky about it. And happiness is overrated also. I mean, all these things are overrated. It depends what you do with them. So anyway, it's complicated. But I think there's a life force in all of us. And if you feel it, you're lucky. And if you don't feel it, you're unlucky. And that's what you have to deal with. Yeah.
But how can we get out of this way of thinking like that? Okay, like, there's this decision. I have so many thoughts in my mind. Like, well, how can I train or become? Well,
who makes you think the way you think? I don't. I don't make you think anyway, right? We just met. I'm not responsible for how you think. But you know, you know who's responsible for how you think? Take your finger and point to your head. Yeah, you are. So change it. That's all. Oh, it's so hard. Yeah, but how did you get to where you are now? You got there. You weren't born with that. You were born with something, but not that. That's not all of that. So you can go back to when you were born, just be stuck with your DNA and reprogram yourself. I mean, people do that all the time. So it's this whole thing of, you know, you just have to go through, and you determine how that all feels. I mean, it's not magic. It's not your parents. You know, your parents are an influence, your friends, your siblings, your environment, but basically it's you. You know, two people in the same environment. I have a guy's coming. I'm actually coming at the end of our talk. He used to be the executive director of the D School when we founded it, and he has a twin brother. They're identical twins, and they were students at Stanford, and I taught them their first design course, and they wouldn't. I tried to get them to be on different teams. They wouldn't. They just would always together. And they're identical twins. I mean, they really look alike. If you don't know them, you can't tell who's who. And they have the same DNA, and yet they're very different people. Mm-hmm. And they went to Stanford. They took exactly the same courses, exactly the same program. They went through the same thing, and yet they're not the same person. So something in them made them different. They had the same environment. They grew up with the same parents in the same household. So it's kind of interesting, right? So there's got to be some personal responsibility that made one different from the other, you know? So it's kind of, you know, but you're unless you're a twin or an identical twin, you're a person, and you have to have that responsibility. And if you don't like it, change it. It's change it. You know, I've worked with a lot of people who change things, and the problem is people get stuck. They think they can't change it. I'm this the way I am. No, that's the way you were yesterday. I used to have a friend, he gave workshops on stopping smoking, and he'd do it in a big auditorium, and there'd be no smoking signs on the auditorium. So he'd go in, and the first thing he'd say, how many of you, and no one is lit up because it's not allowed. And so he'd say, how many of you are smokers? And they'd all raise their hands. He said, but no one is smoking. What do you mean you're a smoker? And he pointed out that it's just their perception that they're smokers. It's in their heads, you know. Mm-hmm. And he did some work to try and get them to change their view, so that, you know, with some success and some failure. But I like that whole idea, because they weren't smoking at the moment, but they thought of themselves as smokers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's that whole thing. Yeah.
Would you then say that's the definition of the self?
Yeah.
That there's like the self thinking and like also like my mind, but also like sometimes they're not cooperating, and sometimes I can own it. I can own my own thoughts.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah. You're responsible for your own thoughts. Yeah. There's that no one else is. I mean, I don't know, unless someone's sending you, put an implant in your brain. And you know, some people don't want to get a vaccination because they're afraid that someone's going to put a chip in their body that's going to control them. You know, that's you know, some Bill Gates is going to somehow control them. Well, if you believe that, then of course,
we don't know.
Bill Gates is responsible. Now you send them a letter, help them, tell them to reprogram it.
And what would you say? How can we train it to own our own force or to practice? Like, what, like, if I see now, I always say, okay, the others, it's
not magic, you know, it's hard work. You just have to do it. It's mm-hmm. not. You have to be serious about doing it. Some people have pipe dreams. They think they want it, but they don't really want to change. It just would be nice, but they don't. But, you know, if you're really serious to do it, you do it. It's, no one's going to stop you from doing it, the general, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are ways, there are techniques that help. But this, in general, it's up to the individual to do it. And it's, we're not perfect. We're all imperfect. So if I say I'm not going to do something, I'll probably do it again. But if I keep telling myself not, eventually I'll change. Mm-hmm. But if I never tell myself I'm not going to do it, I'll never change. Mm-hmm. So it's simply the idea, I call it intention, attention and intention. So you have to have the intention to do it, but it's not going to happen magically. You have to give it the attention. Mm. So you have to want to do it, that's intention. You have to do it, that's attention. Mm-hmm. And the problem is we generally, you know, we don't follow through. So, but it's doable, clearly. It's, people change all the time. It's not unheard of. Lots of people change, you know. It's and I've seen students change. And I get a lot of emails from my book. You know, there's a lot of things in the book that way. But I find, you know, there are things I used to do I don't do anymore, as an example. So I changed, and the things I do now that I never did before. So, you know, that, a good example in my book is lateness. I used to be late to everything in my life. And today I was here ahead of you, right? Yeah, I mean, I'm not late to anything anymore. I'm the pain in the neck who starts everything on time. All my classes start on time and everything. I have a friend, she in our house for dinner one time, she said to me, "Bernie, I hate you." I said, "What do you have against me?" She said, "Since your book came out, everyone comes on time, and no hostess wants people to come on time because I'm not ready when they get here." So I felt good. People change their habits, you know. But it's a simple thing. Like, I was always late. I never cared about it. And now I care about it. So I changed it. It wasn't earth shaking.
How did you change it? What did you do?
I had a realization about it. I used to be on the board of directors of a company in Berkeley, and I would always come late to the board meetings. Every meeting I'd come late, and I'd blame it on the traffic on the highway. Mm-hmm. And there was traffic on the highway. I wasn't lying. But of course, what I realized was I was just not leaving early enough to take into account the real traffic conditions. So I blamed it on the traffic conditions. And the truth was I was leaving too late and I didn't really care to be there. So I had this thing, if I wanted, I should either quit the board or I should take enough responsibility to be there on time. Mm-hmm. And I decided I really do want to be on the board. So I just left on time. And it was simple. I didn't nearly kill myself on the highway, like driving crazy like I used to do. And it just changed everything. And it just gave me the whole realization to be responsible about time. Mm-hmm. And just change. It wasn't hard. Yeah. It was just not having the insight and telling myself it was the traffic. Mm-hmm. As long as I kept telling myself the lie, I call it good reasons, the baloney reasons. Mm-hmm. We all have baloney reasons for our behavior. And as long as you keep telling yourself the baloney reasons, you'll never change. Mm-hmm. But if you tell yourself, you get rid of those, and you don't have to know the reason, you just have to know what the behavior is. Mm-hmm. That you can change it. So I realized the behavior is I was late and I didn't want to be late. So I have to make sure it's not a hard problem. It's not rocket science. Just leave earlier.
Yeah. So, but and, you didn't, then say like they're taking the responsibility back to oneself instead of like giving them to the others is like
instead of giving it to the cars on the road, to the traffic conditions. Sure. Yeah. And it was very easy. In that case, it was very easy. But it was just to not lie, not to believe my lie that it's traffic, which they encouraged me. I come into the meeting, I say, I'm sorry, I'm late. There's big traffic on the highway. And they say, oh, it's okay. As long as nothing happened to you, Bernie, it's okay. But it wasn't okay. And they were supporting my lie by making it okay instead of telling me, you're being rude. You're coming in late. We're waiting for you. We have a life too. Why are you delaying us? You know? So, but the system supported my lie. But once I took responsibility for the true situation, it just was nothing to do. It was not hard. It was actually easier, and it was less, my life became much better that way.
So you made a big decision, just or like a tiny decision in this case, like for just for yourself, and stopped lying to yourself. And why do you think, like, why do we lie to ourselves? What does it help us, and why do we do it?
Because it supports our behavior. You don't want to be at fault. So Bernie coming late is a bad thing. So I can't take the responsibility. So I put it on the traffic. Okay. But in fact, we do that all the time because we have a self-image that I'm a good guy, I'm almost perfect and all that. And when it's not true, my behavior isn't that way, I have to blame it on someone. So I blame it on some external thing, not on myself. It's as simple as that, yeah.
Would you then also say it sometimes, for some people, it would be also easier to just say, okay, I change my image and just say, okay, I am late, and then now I will change something? Or is it easier to stop lying to oneself and to become more punctual?
If you say, look, I'm never going to be late again, you may be late again, but you will change if you keep doing it. If you just say it's the traffic, you'll never change because you have no control over that. There's always going to be the traffic. So I mean, you have to essentially take responsibility and handle what you want to handle. Now, I could just as well have quit the board. That would have been fine too, but I would have lost out on this insight about being on time, which I value, you know. So it's one of these things that, and there's all sorts of behaviors that we have that when people are full of behaviors that are dysfunctional. You know, they eat too much, they drink too much, they do all sorts of things too much, and some things they do too little. They're not kind enough to their relatives or their selves or their friends or their children. So there's a lot of things we do too much of or too little of, and we could change it, really. It's not that hard. It's just simple. And most of these things have big rewards if you do it. And it's just you. There's nothing. And nobody cared when I left, you know. nobody was aware I was going to the meeting, except the people at the meeting were waiting for. But, you know, in my environment at Stanford, I didn't tell anyone I was going to Berkeley to a meeting. No one cared. It was just my personal behavior, my personal thing that I was doing on the outside of my job. So it's that thing. And I think there are a lot of things in our life, if we just stop and look at them and stop giving us baloney excuses, we could change them. They're not very hard. Some things are harder, you know. Some things are harder. You may have physiological things working in a way against you and stuff. But many things are not. They're just habits, stupid habits that you have. And if you get rid of them, it's really simple. Just, you know, and some people change like that. You know, they get an illness, they get diabetes, and suddenly they stop drinking or they stop eating sweets or whatever it is because they get worried about the diabetes. Others have diabetes and they still do these things and they get into worse trouble. So it's just a matter of the habits that you have. Most of them are just habits. They just things you've done repeatedly, and if you stop doing it, it can be strange that you ever did it. I mean, there's certain things I look back upon, I can't believe I used to do them, you know. They just seems like so ridiculous. And you know, and some people do life-threatening things that they maybe get away with it, and then they look back and think, did I really do that? It was really stupid. I remember, you know, I remember some things. It's like, I can't believe I did them. I'm lucky I got away with them. You know?
But for example?
Oh, it's just things like, it's, you know, they're just things with cars and stuff, you know, when you're teenagers. And,
yeah.
they're very dangerous things. But and luckily nothing happened. So I'm here to tell you the tale. Yeah. But I don't. I wouldn't do it anymore. So
better it is. And what would you then say? Like, how can we form new habits? Because some people say if you connect a new habit to an old habit, it's easier to change.
Yeah. Well, new habit. A habit is just something you do over and over again without thinking in general, and without thinking about it. I mean, you know, you don't think whether you should do it; you just do it. So it's just a matter of becoming habituated to it. So if you do it, you know, if every day you make up that you're going to write a letter to a friend or to a relative, and you can do it every morning, you can get up at 6 a.m. and from 6 to 7, you're going to do it. In the beginning, it may be really hard and all that, but after you did it for 2 months, it's just your life. You can't even imagine not doing it. An example. So, you know, it's just a matter of, if it's strange, you have to kind of force yourself. There's all sorts of things. People have rewards. There are things called triggers that people have, which you attach it to something else. So when you brush your teeth in the morning, you always pick up your pen because it's near your toothbrush, and then you remember to do the list, you know, stuff like that. So you make it kind of more automatic. Yeah, they're all different theories on changing behavior and how you do them. But
yeah. Also, like, not to do too many new habits, because like many people say then, okay, I want to change everything. Like, I do like this new habit and that new habit, and then it's really hard.
Yeah. Well, you see, I mean, that's like, you take like something and you make an exaggeration, of course, but nobody changes everything. So, you know, maybe they can. I mean, people want to change everything, generally commit suicide, you know. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's basically, if you feel life is hopeless and there's nothing to change and all that, that's people like that often take their lives, you know, because they feel it's, you know, there are other reasons that people could, but that's one reason. So, you know, but hopefully you're not in that state. It's just, instead of, see, if you try to change everything, you're going to change nothing. But if you just take one little thing at a time, then you can change stuff. So you could say, look, I want to change this thing. And once I've done that for quite a while, that I'm pretty sure it's part of my life, now I'm going to choose the next thing to change. You know, that's a reasonable thing. But as I say, if you choose everything, you're going to change nothing, basically. So it's not a matter of, you know, it depends on you and your willpower. But really, it comes back to intention and attention, you know.
And what do you tell students or teach students when they come to you and ask you, how can I find out what my path is? Like, because so many students get to ask me also, like, how can I find out what my purpose or my path is?
Yeah. Well, you just tell them, keep awake. You'll know at the end. I mean, there's this whole thing of finding your, you know, flow and finding your calling and all that sort of stuff. I don't think you can find that out by sitting and dreaming and daydreaming and talking. You just do stuff in life. And then if it works, that's your path. If it didn't work, get a different path. So you find out by doing. That's how you find out. It's not a matter of, and not by looking for it either. You can't find it if you look for it. You just do. Just live your life, you know.
And at the end, I always have two questions. Yeah. So the first one would be, what would you tell your younger self? Maybe let's say that the younger self who changed to the Stanford campus, what would you tell yourself when you were able to meet you?
I'm not in it. What would I tell myself?
You know, myself in the age when you came to Stanford and decided, now I'm a professor here in Stanford. So what would you tell yourself when you were able to meet yourself?
Well, I don't know. I took a job to teach, and I had to make the job work. So, you know, there were, not every day was great, and you know, and I explored what I was going to teach on. But I didn't have like a long range vision or goal or so. Mm-hmm. I just had a job basically, which I was enjoying doing, and I was doing research, and mm-hmm. I was just busy doing things and raising a family, and I was too busy doing my life to worry about it. I remember one of my young colleagues came up to me, he says, you know, we might not get tenure. And I said, look, if they don't keep us, who's going to teach? They got to keep us. I wasn't worried for 1 minute that they wouldn't give me tenure. It just seemed to me we were doing the job, and why wouldn't they? Who's going to do it if we don't do it? Mm-hmm. So I had a pragmatic thing. I just day to day did my job, and I enjoyed it. The various decisions, I got involved in robotics. That was exciting. And I got involved in teaching new ways. And, you know, just and I explored California. I enjoyed that. And I spent a lot of time in San Francisco. So, you know, I had young children. And so my life was pretty full. So it isn't, I wasn't telling myself anything. I was just getting up in the morning and handling the day and going to bed and handling the next day. So, and I have that view. It's very pragmatic. I only worry about, like, I know after I'm done talking with you, what I'm going to do next. And then maybe I know where I'm going to have dinner tonight. But that's about it. The rest will unfold itself tomorrow. I have no idea what I'm going to do on Saturday. And Sunday, I bike every morning, Sunday morning. So I know I'll bike that. But I have no idea what I'm going to do with those days. They just come on, you know.
So then the next question will be really, maybe I'm curious about that too, if you can answer that. Because when you will now be able to meet your 100-year-old self, yes. What would you want your 100-year-old self to tell you now, what other people have learned from you?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's I'd say hopefully they've learned to have a nice life and to treat the people in their lives well. And I hope they felt that I treated them well, and they passed it on to the way they treated others. Most people in my life, I think, are that way. I think they're decent human beings, and that's what, and hopefully they had a good life. I don't know. I had a good colleague. He just died 2 weeks ago, and someone I was very close to. And I think he had a very good life. And, you know, I'm sorry he died, but he was 94 years old. And, it happens. That's so I don't know. But we shared many things. We did a lot of things together. And he learned a lot of things from me, and I learned a lot of things from him. And I'm grateful to him. My life wouldn't have been the same without him. And I think he died grateful to me, although I'm sure he wasn't thinking of me when he was dying. But you're part of a network, you're part of a community. And if you can just look back and think that's great and not regret too many things, everyone has stuff they regret, but hopefully most of the stuff you feel good about. So that's, hopefully that's, and I think I had the same idea when I was younger. I don't think it's a universal idea.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. And also, thanks so much for talking to you. It was a real pleasure to me.
Okay. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Ich hoffe, es hat dir Spaß gemacht, dieses Interview anzuhören, darüber zu erfahren, wie Bernard es sieht, Gewohnheiten zu etablieren, Gewohnheiten aufzubauen und vor allem eben auch, wie du es schaffen kannst, ein erfülltes und glückliches Leben zu erreichen. Und ja, wenn du es noch nicht gemacht hast, dann würde ich mich unglaublich über eine Bewertung von dir freuen auf iTunes und lass mich auch super gerne wissen, wie dieses Jahr so für dich war, wie waren die Interviews, was hat dir am meisten Spaß gemacht, was hat dir am besten gefallen, was für Themen interessieren dich, was hat dich am meisten bewegt. Also lass mir unglaublich gerne dein Feedback da, ich würde mich sehr darüber freuen. Und wenn wir in den Austausch gehen, uns darüber unterhalten, einfach was dir wichtig ist, was dich interessiert. Und dann hören wir uns schon ganz, ganz bald wieder hier im Evolve Podcast. Bis dann, deine Jasmin.